Good evening, everybody. Great to be back gathered with you. To start tonight, I want us to ask you all a question. Has God promised you anything? Has God given you specifically any promises? As we study the Old Testament, as we read the whole Bible, I think it's fairly clear that the promises of God are a central narrative to just about everything. They are a driving force to everything that is going on in the Old Testament. Especially, I hope this has been clear as we've been studying Genesis. If it's not, I haven't been doing a very good job. But as we study Genesis, it's continually coming back to things that God is promising and God trying to fulfill these promises. And this goes all the way back to the creation of man with Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, God promised to them that if they ate from the tree of knowledge and good and evil, they would surely die, promising them that fate. And then when they ate from the tree and they took on death, God promised that he would save them. He promises that he will not leave man in their state of sin. With Noah, we see God flood the earth and then promise to Noah through the rainbow that he was never going to do it again. With Abraham, we get three of the most important promises and probably ever. The promise to Abraham that he would have the land that he walked on, that his descendants would be more than the stars in the sky, that the Messiah would come through his lineage. And as we read the story of the Bible and we read all these different passages, it is so clear how everything points back to a promise of God and how he is trying to fulfill those promises. Exodus, God is taking his people out of Egypt and into the promised land. Joshua, conquering the promised land. All the prophets are promises from God. But while it is easy to see exactly what God promised people like Abraham, what has he promised you, us? Now, I don't think any of us have been guaranteed to have children that will outnumber the stars or the grains of sand in the ocean. But seeing how important the promises of God are in the story of the Bible should show us that the promises that we have received, if we've received any promises, should be very important to us. And so I'd like to point you real quick to 2 Peter 1, verses 3 through 4, because in 2 Peter, Peter is very obsessed with this idea of promises, and the promises specifically that have been given to us. In 2 Peter 1, 3 through 4, Peter says this: His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature. Peter here tells us that we have been given great promises, but not only that, these promises are how we become partakers in the divine nature, saying that this is how we become one with Christ. It's how we reunite with God. And so clearly, not only are just promises in general a very important part of the Bible, but these promises that we have been given are extremely important to us if they allow us to become partakers of the divine nature. And so if in the question of what have we been promised, if we've been promised, I'd point you to verses like Matthew 1:21, where it is a reminder of God's promise of salvation, the very one that he gave to Adam and Eve and to Abraham and passed down to generations, or verses like John 4:14, which tell us about the promise of eternal life we have, or John 14:2, which tells us that Christ will return, or just look at books like Hebrews and Philippians, which continually promise us God's comfort through our trials. And while I would hope at least none of these promises are too new to any of you, I do want to know if we've ever doubted these promises. If it's ever come up in our lives to where we have questioned if it's going to happen. If our difficulties or trials make us wonder if God is truly going to comfort us. If our hard times and trials that come into our lives, if it makes us wonder when Christ is coming back, when these promises of his return are coming. And this leaves us with a very interesting question. What does God owe us? And while this may sound like a bad question, right, a wrong question to ask, and maybe even sacrilegious in some senses, it's very important for us to face, especially when we start talking about these promises that have been given to us by God. Because if God has promised us, well, then what does he owe us? What does he owe to these promises that he has given to us? And this dilemma is the very one that Habakkuk faces at the end of chapter 1 and the rest of chapter 2. Habakkuk, last time we talked about Habakkuk, in the first 11 verses, was struggling with how to see God in the broken world around him. But now we're going to see him struggle to put together the pieces of his expectations of the promises of God. And we're going to see God respond to those expectations. And so if you haven't already, go ahead and open up your Bibles to Habakkuk chapter 1. And we're going to start in verse 12, as it is where Habakkuk's second complaint picks up. And we're going to be focusing from Habakkuk 1:12 all the way through the second chapter. Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to read through all of this, and so I'll try to walk you through what happens in just Habakkuk 1:12 through the end of chapter 1, because that is where Habakkuk's second complaint is all focused. Now, if you look through your Bibles, you'll notice Habakkuk starts by stating facts about God's character. See, he starts out by calling God, saying that he's from everlasting. He calls God a rock. He says that he has holy nature and pure eyes, that he is powerful and above man. But then this complaint kind of starts to switch after that. Because then he starts to get into this metaphor about God being a fisherman and man being his fish. And in doing this, Habakkuk ends with verse 17. He ends with this question. In verse 17, he says, "Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever?" And that sounds like a big question. That's like a difficult question, because it is. But what it is pointing to is the words that Habakkuk says in verse 12. He is relating this question back to what he claimed at the very start of his complaint in verse 12. Habakkuk starts his statement by saying, "We shall not die." He makes this great claim that we will not die. He was confident in the fate of Judah, that they would be okay. However, verse 17 is kind of like Habakkuk saying, although I know we should not die and we're not supposed to die yet, it kind of sounds like death is coming, like we are about to be in great struggle. Habakkuk was confused by the workings of God here. He was confused by the promises of what that God had given him, which seemed to be conflicting with his now actions. Habakkuk wanted justice in Judah. If we remember to the last time we were talking about Habakkuk, his very first complaint was all about the terrible things that were going on in Judah. He said that there was injustice and there was evil and wickedness. And so he complains to God and says, "I need you to do something." And then God responds with saying, "I am doing something. I'm about to send the Babylonians and they're going to correct Judah, to destroy Judah." And so Habakkuk is faced with this internal conflict of saying, while I want Judah to change, I didn't expect that they were going to get wiped out. This isn't quite what I thought, how I thought this was going to go. He wanted God to turn them back to righteousness and instead of destroying them with the nation of Babylon. And while I think that there is a point here to talk about how we expect God to fulfill these promises, how we expect God to work when he promises us things, I actually think there is another point to get at. But before we can talk about that, we need to come to a different conclusion. Habakkuk's confusion here was rational. And while that might sound like a weird point to make, I want to walk you through exactly why Habakkuk was confused. Why he was so confident in the first place to be able to say before God, "We shall not die." That is a very confident statement, and there's reason why he is able to proclaim this in verse 12, to say, "We shall not die." And so let's, real quick, look at why Habakkuk expected this from God, why he expected that they would not die. You see, the reason Habakkuk says we shall not die actually goes back to some of those promises we brought up at the start of today's lesson. In Genesis 3, God promises to Adam and Eve that he is going to save man. In Genesis 15, God promises Abraham, the promises of fruitfulness, of land, and the Messiah. And then in Genesis 35, God promises to Jacob, Abraham's grandson, these same promises, and inherently in that moment creates the nation of Israel. He creates the nation of Israel based on these three promises right here. And in doing this, God gives a guarantee of hope to the Israelites, to the people of Israel. You see, because God had promised them fruitfulness, land, and the Messiah, they could have confidence that they were not going to be wiped off the face of the map until God fulfilled these promises, because God was going to fulfill these promises. That they did not, they could take full confidence and say, as Habakkuk did, "We shall not die." And so now I want you to put yourself in Habakkuk's shoes for a moment, to think about what it must have been like for him in that moment. You see, everything Habakkuk would have learned growing up about his people would have pointed back to the fact of these promises. But more than that, it would have pointed back to the fact that God always fulfills these promises. That the stories of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt is all about how God is going to go great strides to fulfill his promises. That the stories of Joshua and Caleb conquering the evil nations in Canaan is all about God, again, fulfilling these promises for the Israelites. Everything Habakkuk would have known would have been about how God is willing to go great strides to fulfill his promises to his people. And so, as Habakkuk, you can live in hope. You can live in hope that even as the people around you, the people of Judah, are doing terrible things, one day things will change. One day they will have to turn around, because one day the Messiah is going to have to come. One day all other nations are going to have to be saved through your nation. And so you can confidently say, "We shall not die." No matter how terrible things get, you can have hope in what God has promised you. But now, Habakkuk was faced with God's plan. He was just told that Judah was going to be destroyed. Babylon was coming. And in hearing this news, the first thing Habakkuk does is he thinks back to these promises of God, these promises that he has hope in. These promises he knew that God would one day fulfill. And so here we have the source of Habakkuk's confusion. Habakkuk expected great things from God. However, he only expected what God had promised. And this is a very interesting dilemma that is being faced here. Habakkuk is saying, "I know what you've promised. I have great faith in your promises. Why isn't it coming true? What is happening? Please make it make sense." It is utter confusion for Habakkuk. See, Habakkuk expected that Judah would survive only because of what God had promised. And this leaves us with a very important question for us to balance. How do we handle the promises of God? Habakkuk expected great things from these promises, but it was only because he had great faith. And the reason I can say confidently that Habakkuk's confusion was rooted in what was rational and that it made sense is because of verses like Mark 11. Mark 11 tells us this. It says, "And Jesus answered them, 'Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours.'" You see, for this reason, we can say that Habakkuk's confusion was completely understandable, because his confusion was rooted in faith, rooted in the faith that God would one day fulfill his promises. And it takes faith, great faith, to expect that God will stay faithful to you. It takes great faith that even as things are going horribly around you, even as the whole nation around you has turned away from God, God has not left you. God has not forgotten his promises. And so Habakkuk, left uncertain, not knowing where to go next, says this in chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 2, the very start of chapter 2, Habakkuk says, "I don't know what's going on, so I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me." Habakkuk is confused about where to go next, and so he says, all right, God, I'm ready to listen. And I think it's important for us because this is a very weird dilemma that's going on here. Habakkuk has great faith in the promises of God, only now it's not going to happen, or it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So how do we balance these two things? And so let's look at God's response to see how he corrects Habakkuk's thoughts here. Now, in the rest of chapter 2, verses 2 through 20, we're going to get God responding to Habakkuk. And this can be broken up into two sections. You get the first section, which is verses 2 through 5. And this is God telling Habakkuk how to act. He's saying, continue to act like this. But then in verses 6 through 20, God is going to directly respond to Habakkuk's confusion and directly respond to what led Habakkuk to his confusion. And he's going to help him out in this. And so I want to skip those first five verses and go to verse 6 to see how God is going to respond. And then we're going to come back later to see how God is telling him to act. So looking at verses 6 through 20. God here is going to explain exactly how the destruction of Judah fits with his promises. And again, without reading it, I want you to just scan through. And if you notice, a lot of these verses are going to start with woes. God is going to be giving out a lot of woes to Habakkuk. He says, woe to this, woe to that. And the reason he is doing this is to show Habakkuk what Judah had done to go wrong. He says, these are the things Judah had done wrong. In verse 8, God points to the violence and cruelty of Judah. In verse 9, God even goes so far as to say, or in verse 10, God goes as far as to say that they forfeited their life. They forfeited their life in these wrongdoings that they were doing. God here, in saying woe to these people, he is reminding Habakkuk why he came to God in the first place. He is saying, I know it might be confusing now, but remember why you even came to me. The first 11 verses of Habakkuk 1 is Habakkuk saying, look at how terrible everything's going on. Do you not see how all the awful things that are happening? And God says here, I see it. There, it's all awful. Hey, you're right. This is wrong. This is wrong. And so he's telling Habakkuk, they forfeited. In these wrongdoings, the reason I'm working is because of why you even complained to me. But then, and from verses 12 to 19, God does something really, really interesting in his response to Habakkuk's confusion. You see, the reason Habakkuk was able to take great faith in the promises of God was because he was pulling on the past. He was able to know what God had promised his ancestors and how faithful God had been in his past. And so what God is going to do to respond to his confusion is to point to Habakkuk's past. He's going to point to three historical figures that model this very fact. People who were able to have the promises of God, but instead forfeited them away. And so what I want to do is look at these three people. Look at these three references that God makes in verses 12 through 19. And so let's go ahead and look at those three. Verses 12 through 19, God is going to start in verse 12 by saying, woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. And here, God is referring to Cain. This is the story of Cain, who in Genesis 4 kills his own brother and then runs away from God and builds a city. He builds his own city that then all sorts of bad things start to come from the city. It's a direct reference to Cain. Then he's going to go on to reference the son of Noah, Hem, who, in verse 15, God says, woe to him who makes his neighbor drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. And again, this is referencing Genesis chapter 9, in which the son of Noah shames his father by taking advantage of him while he is naked and drunk and mocks him to his brothers. Then finally, in verse 18, God is going to reference the golden calf. Verse 18, God says, what profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image of a teacher of lies, for its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Referencing here, Exodus 32, the golden calf in which the Israelites, the people of Israel, were punished for bowing down to an image made of metal. And while if we were just looking at these three in a box, right? Trying to figure out what was connecting them. It might be a little tricky. And so I want to you to see this common theme that ties all three of these together. It's twofold. One, each of these people, at one point or another, received a promise from God. They were able to partake in a promise of God. But then the second thing that unites these three people, or peoples, is that while each of these stories references people that could have received promises of God, he references the exact moment these people turn away from God and reject the promises of God. For example, look to Cain. Look to Cain. Cain, who was the son of Adam and Eve. Cain, who had the ability and the opportunity to serve God just like his brother, just like his family. He had the opportunity to be a part of that promise that his parents received. But instead, he decides to kill his brother and to found a city on blood and iniquity. Look to the son of Noah. Look to him who had this one really. When we look at Genesis chapter 9, it really drives home this point. Because just verses before this reference here, God creates a covenant with the sons of Noah. It is the only people on earth at this point. God says, well done, great faith. I now want to use you to build my earth again. I want you to use you to create my people. And that he adds them into this covenant. And then just verses later, and turns around and he mocks his father and he curses himself by rejecting God. And then, of course, the golden calf, the Israelite, who before Mount Sinai, literally before the presence of God on Mount Sinai, instead of bowing down to God, worshiping God, they get punished because they instead choose to worship an image made of metal. Each of these stories shows someone who had the opportunity to obtain the promises of God, but instead received punishment. And each of these points to a pattern of God's relationship between God, between man and himself. It points to this pattern, that God offers grace, and man chooses wickedness. And in reminding Habakkuk about these three specific stories, he is teaching Habakkuk about a lesson about Judah. You see, Habakkuk was completely correct in knowing that God wanted to give Judah prosperity, that God wanted to bless Judah and give them these great promises. However, Habakkuk's confusion came from him not realizing the role that Judah played in accepting these promises. He had forgotten the ability that Judah had to choose to be a part of these promises. Habakkuk had correctly assessed the gracious nature of God, which wants to give us his blessings freely, but he had forgotten the role Judah played. He forgot that while God tries to freely give us his blessings, he does not force anyone to accept them. And so Babylon was coming to destroy Judah because although they had the opportunity to accept God's promises, they had chosen to turn away from him and reject them. This is why Judah was going to be destroyed. This is where his confusion came from. Habakkuk had great faith to say, I know what you have promised, and we shall not die. But his confusion came from not realizing the role of Judah. And this leaves us with a very important answer to Habakkuk's confusion over the promises of God. God never fails his end. God is always going to fulfill his promises. And so in the question of should we expect that God will fulfill his promises to us, it should always be yes. 100%, without a doubt, we can take full confidence that God will do it. And we should expect that he will do it. However, if we expect to turn away from God and still receive those promises, we're only fooling ourselves. We need to also expect that turning away from God gets us nothing. We should expect that God will fulfill his promises, but we cannot expect separating from God gets us anything. And when we are wondering where God is, when trials come, when difficulties come, when the world looks opposite to God, it is so ironic and hypocritical to push God away and say, why don't I feel close to you? Why don't I feel close to you as I turn and run from God? Those two things do not work together. So God's final reminder to Habakkuk and to us is that God never fails his people. But are you choosing to be one of his people? And this is where I want to call our minds back to 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 4, real quick. 2 Peter 1, 3 through 4 says, his divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature. We should know that it is these promises that we have received that allow us to be partakers in the divine nature. Or, in other words, it is these promises that have been granted to us that allow us to become one with God, that allow us to become the people of God. The question is, do we have the faith to live by these promises? Or, when life gets confusing like it did for Habakkuk, when life gets terrible, will we not do what Habakkuk did? And will we turn away and run from God? Will we give up on those promises? Will we lose our faith in God's ability to fulfill his promises? And so it's why in verse 4 of chapter 2, I think God says these words. He says, the righteous shall live by faith. The righteous shall live by faith. He says that those who choose to be one of God's people, those who choose to be righteous, choose to take faith in the promises of God. Meaning trusting in God's ability to fulfill his promises is the very definition of living by faith. If you want to know what living by faith looks like, it's to live by the promises of God. Taking full faith, fully trusting in it, acting as if we know, because we know, they will be fulfilled. God will be faithful to his promises. And so now I want to see the rest of verses 2 through 5 in chapter 2 to see how God calls Habakkuk to live and how he defines this living by faith even further. Because God shows exactly what it looks like to live by faith above all else. And so to answer this question, start in verse 4. Look at verse 4. God says this. He says, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by faith. Verse 4, it's where we get this saying, the righteous shall live by faith. But what I find very interesting is that God chooses to clash the idea of living by faith with the idea of being puffed up. He clashes it with the idea of pride. That he says that the prideful refuse to live by faith. And what I want you to notice is why this is difficult. Why it is difficult for the prideful to live by faith. You see, the prideful look at the uncertainty of life, and they assess the promises of God, and they decide to live by themselves instead, to trust in themselves instead. The puffed up believe that they will be better off on their own. They will be better off without the promises of God. They don't need those promises. And so, of course, trusting in God and living by faith is very difficult when we take pride and when we allow ourselves to become puffed up. Meaning, for us, when uncertainties come, the best thing we can do is test ourselves. And I want us to try to test ourselves in this way. When trials come, see who you go to first. See the first thing you do when hardships come. When questions arise, do you go to the Word? Do you pray? Do you seek answers from God, or do you trust in your own wisdom? Do you try to find answers in self and things that work for me? Or are we worried about what God has promised and what God is going to do in us? And the reason I say test ourselves by going, by seeing who we go to first in trials is because the one we go to first is the one we truly have trust in. It's the one we truly have faith in. And so if to be puffed up is to take comfort in self, if we are not going to God first, then we have messed this up. But God goes on in verse 5 by saying this. Verse 5, he says, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own peoples. He says, wealth, wine, whatever it is, fill in the blank. God is now pointing to greed. But much like how Pride was used to describe those who take comfort in self. Greed is those that take comfort in anything exterior. And so again, we can do this same test. What are we going to first when trials arise? Maybe we don't go to ourselves first. Maybe we don't trust in ourselves. But when difficulties come, are we quicker to go to a friend, or are we quicker to go to the Word? Are we quicker to go to prayer in God, with God? And maybe we find comfort in vices like wine and wealth, which is brought up in this. Maybe we find vices in more nefarious things like lust, like anger, like gluttony. Anything can become a vice for us. Anything can become a distraction from living by faith if we allow it to become our main priority. And so we must test ourselves. What do we go to first? Are we going to God, or are we finding comfort in anything else? But after this, or with this, while defining the two biggest hurdles to living by faith, God then explains exactly what it looks like. He gives a very, very clear picture of what it looks like to live by faith in verse 3. In verse 3, God says, "For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." God says, wait. Living by faith, trusting in the promises of God, they are defined that they look like waiting. And if we are willing to wait, we will. That is the definition of living by faith and trusting in the promises. When we truly believe that God will be faithful to his promises, then no matter what trials come, no matter what hardships come, we will be willing to wait. We will wait for God to fulfill. True faith looks at what we don't know, looks at our uncertainties and says, "I am willing to wait through this trial for God to answer." And I think it is best modeled by Habakkuk in chapter 2, verse 1. When Habakkuk says, "I'm unsure about what's going on." When he looks at the evilness around him and says, "I don't quite get what you're doing, God." But then he says, "But I will wait for you. I will wait for you. I will wait for you to answer me. And I will keep doing what I need to do until I hear your response." And again, I love how this echoes the words of Peter in 2 Peter, only in chapter 3, where he says, "The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance." And then Peter goes on in verse 14 by saying, "Therefore, beloved, since you are waiting for these, be diligent to be found by him without spot or blemish and at peace." To live by faith is to wait. To trust in God is to wait. We have been granted many great and wonderful promises. God is looking to fulfill those promises in your life. He is looking to give you comfort. He is looking to offer you salvation. He just wants us to wait. And you can expect that God will fulfill those promises. No matter how long it takes, God will fulfill his promises. Because when we have faith in God's promises, no matter how long it takes, we will diligently wait. And as Peter says, we will seek to spot out every blemish, becoming better for the sake of him who waits for us. So brothers and sisters, remember this. This is the point of Habakkuk 1:12 through 2:20. God will be faithful to his promises. Do you have the faith to wait for him? Let's go to God in prayer.